London Calling, David here. This is another of our Meet Your Guide interviews, talks. I've got Fiona on the other end of the line. I always tease her a bit. I always say, you, Fiona, are our most decorated guide. if you were a colonel or a general in the military with all those badges and medals and ribbons on the front of your uniform, you'd be referred to as a fruit salad. But anyway, yeah. So let's go over to you. I want to know about Fiona growing up. Are you a London Rose? Did you grow up in London?
Partially, yes. I was born here and was here until about 2.5. And then we went to the Middle East because my dad was an architect and was building a zoo in Qatar, in Doha. So we lived in the Middle East for about 2.5 years, which I don't really remember that much because, we came back when I was 5 and I have sort of hazy impressions of smells and warmth and things like that. And then was living in London again from 5 to university, kind of when I went to Sheffield.
Was that the only zoo he designed?
His company worked a bit on London Zoo at times, or certainly they did. I can't remember exactly why, but he definitely has walked around the back of the monkey cages at London Zoo as sort of research and things. So I can't remember whether they were actually doing work there or it was just sort of connected somehow.
Well, speaking of monkeys, you know where they're going to at the zoo now?
No.
Well, you know that amazing sort of bird cage that...
The aviary, the yeah. Snowdon.
Yeah, that's yes. Been redesigned for the monkeys.
Ah, that's so very nice.
I walked along there the other day and I saw a warthog and yeah. I saw hyenas and I was thrilled at the thought that I'll be able to see the monkeys and
yeah.
Maybe have them throw things at me. So did you... were you interested in zoos then? Did that spark an interest in you, that early experience?
Not really. I do have a vague memory of, and I mean, this must be one of my earliest memories in a way, but I remember there being something. I remember my dad sitting at the drawing board and he was doing something about the cafe that was sort of suspended on stilts. But it had to be a certain height above what was below, which was the crocodile pool. because crocodiles can jump upwards quite effectively. So obviously they had to make sure that the crocodiles couldn't get up.
Can they, Fiona? I didn't know that. Crocodiles or can...
unless it was alligators, I'm not sure. But one of the two.
They can come up out of the water, can they?
They seemingly. But no, I don't think it sparked a great interest in zoos.
Okay. So then you're back in London and off you go to school. What were you like as a kid? Were you a good girl, a good student, or a rebel? Were you a bit of a rebel, Fiona?
I don't think I was a rebel. I was reasonably good. I went to 2 primary schools, and because I had eczema, I did get bullied at one of them, so I don't have particularly fond memories of that.
Uh-huh.
And then the second one was much better. And I suspect I was a better student at the second one.
Uh-huh.
We did one time at secondary school, there was a group of us who felt very strongly there should be somewhere that we should be able to eat our packed lunches. Because we were in houses at school, like lots of groups. So, but my friendship group, we were all in different houses, so we couldn't eat our lunch together because we were supposed to eat our lunch in each of our house rooms or somewhere outside. But we thought, no, we can't. This isn't right. There should be somewhere we should eat our packed lunch. So as a protest, we decided the best way to do this would be to protest by sitting outside the headmistress's office to eat our packed lunch. And then when someone challenged us, we would be able to say, there's nowhere else that we can eat our lunch together indoors, so we're eating it here. And we were all ready to do this. And nobody challenged us. And she didn't walk past, and nobody minded at all. So it didn't really work as a protest. And I think we just did it once, was it.
You don't have to put your hand up and say guilty as charged, but I'm guessing, Fiona Lucas, that you were the brains behind this operation, that you masterminded this thing.
Not necessarily. No. I've got... it's a school. It's a friendship group that I'm still friends with, and we were quite, you know, between us, we had plenty of people who were quite vocal about things.
Yeah, women are so. Females are so good at friendship. They're, I think, for the most part, much better than our lot are. But there you go. What about subjects, Fiona? What did you have favorite subjects at school?
I gave up history as soon as I could.
Oh, really?
Which is...
And look at where you are now!
Exactly. So much so that, you know, when I started kind of guiding and when I first met my husband, there were times, because he studied history at university and things, so there were times when I said to him things like, the Second World War? When was it again? Because, you know, I didn't... But the sort of history we learnt at school, it just wasn't... It didn't connect with me in any way. So I didn't have... It didn't seem relevant to me. It was only later when I sort of started walking, you know, seeing the streets of London and connecting... Kind of the Great Fire of London is what was the most tangible thing that you could say, well, on this street, on this date, this street burnt, and then 2 days later it was over there. And it was really kind of gripping. So that's what sucked me back into kind of history.
Fascinating. So was there a sort of Damascene moment, a moment on the road to Damascus, an epiphany then?
No, not specifically, but I trained as an actress. And then I was working at the London Dungeon and kind of discovered Jack the Ripper. Because, you know, so that I think that's how I came to London Walks, was through, you know, Jack the Ripper walking tours and things. And then I was also working teaching juggling, and I had a job for the City of London Corporation, which was... they were having some sort of meeting, like residence meeting, they wanted lots of people to come to, so they put on activities for the kids so that, you know, there was like the equivalent of a creche so that parents could all come to the meeting. So I was in the crypt, the medieval crypt of the Guildhall of the City of London, running a juggling workshop with, you know, juggling and feather balancing and scarves and things, but also diabolos, which are quite chunky rubber things. And the idea of the fun thing to do with a diabolo is flick it up into the air. And they're, you can flick them quite fast. And I was watching these kids throwing diabolos around with great vigour, thinking, how old are these walls that we're potentially damaging here? Or is this right? And, you know, the staff were very like, no, that's fine, you do your thing. But that going into the crypt of the Guildhall again, I mean, the Guildhall itself is an astonishing building that lots of people don't ever have a reason to go into. And then also to be doing a job in the crypt, it was kind of like, what is this place? Why is it here? What else has happened here over the years? So that was partly what I think inspired me to kind of sign up for the City Guides course, which was the one I did first.
I'm so impressed that you can juggle. How many tennis balls can you juggle?
I can do three, and I can do tricks with three. I can do five for at least seven throws. So I can catch the first two balls that I throw when I've got five in my hands and throw them again. But I can do clubs as well, but not, you know. If you're teaching kids, you only have to be better than the kids. But it is a skill. Absolutely anyone can learn it. It just, some people learn it quicker than others. But the logic behind teaching it was partly to teach kids juggling, but also to get kids to understand the process of learning. So any skill, you can break it down into component parts and you can practice those parts and then build it up gradually. And so it's a really good way to learn how to learn. That was the logic of the company that I was working for.
And that's probably true of guiding as well, and you teach guiding, but we'll get on to that.
Mm-hmm.
My anxiety levels would be so high if I were trying to juggle, but this has given me an idea. I think we need to have you standing outside a tube stop before the start of the walk, juggling. They're not going to miss you.
I would have to do a bit of practice. I'm a little bit rusty. But also it's a different thing. I mean, you know, the fact I can juggle doesn't necessarily mean I'm a good person to come on a walking tour with. So it may or may not be a good advert.
Yeah.
And also, beside the street is a slightly worrying place to do juggling.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they can take our word for that and take the word of your thousands of thrilled walkers that you're a good person to go on a walking tour with. What about the escapology? Because you do that as well, don't you?
I don't really do that. No. I think that came about because I used to work at the London Dungeon.
All right.
And now I don't. And somehow that turned into escapology. I never really...
What a colourful past! It's like you ran away to the circus or something.
Yeah. Yeah, well, the juggling came out of being at drama school because it was you know, people I knew from drama school who ran the company and things.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, as an actor, I guess actors were early adopters, if you like, of what a lot of people do nowadays, which is portfolio careers.
Yeah.
So, you know, you do have a variety of jobs so that you can be flexible. And that's also originally why I started doing walking tours, because I thought, well, this is something I can do alongside other things.
Uh-huh.
And then I found out I enjoyed it enough that it was I was quite happy doing this without waiting for other things to come along.
When I was listening to you last night on the letter L the London A to Z, you sang a little bit, and I was just wondering, at drama school, did you sing and dance and act, or just mainly act?
A bit of all of them. We had lots of different dance classes of various sorts, and we weren't a school that specialised particularly in musical theatre or whatever, so we did some, but not as much as some drama courses would do. I did have a singing lesson not that long ago, I mean a year and a half or something, there was some sort of event and we won it in a raffle prize, or it was a fundraising thing or whatever. Anyway, so I had effectively a private singing lesson with the music teacher who used to teach us at drama school. And in the meantime, I've sung with quite a lot of choirs. And I think we were both a little bit like apprehensive about having this private lesson. And when I started singing then, he kind of went, oh, that's so much better than you were at drama school. So, I did sing, but not, I still prefer singing in a group rather than singing on my own. Generally.
Well, I mean, you know how Mary and I feel about these things. I mean, it's so often the case that actors, they really make great guides, providing they learn their stuff. I mean, what is it about that skill set? I suppose it's audience awareness and the voice.
Yeah.
And
enjoying being center of attention, I think, is quite a big part of it.
You're so honest, Fiona.
But it's intriguing as well, because at drama school I did do some training as a director as well. And there's something about storytelling, you know, that the heart of good guiding is stories, and that's what actors and directors do, is tell stories.
Uh-huh.
But also the way that you design a walk is... you put pieces together so that by the end you've got a kind of nice full story.
Uh-huh.
And you direct people's attention in the way that, you know, a film director chooses a particular shot for a particular moment because they want to have the audience looking at one particular thing, and in a sense, as a guide, we're doing that as well, and saying, come and stand here in front of me, because that's the way you'll get the best view of this thing that I want to tell you about. So there's quite a lot of overlap of skills.
Yeah, that is so well put. Did you acted in drama school, and you know about directing. Did you actually act professionally at all? Well, I guess
yes.
You did at the... well, go on.
At the dungeon.
Yeah.
Yes. I did a handful of fringe shows. I say a handful. There's only now one that springs immediately to mind. I was Titania in a pub theatre in Highgate.
Uh-huh.
Which was fabulous to do. I did do other things.
You don't miss any of that, though.
I mean,
you're getting it through your guiding, aren't you?
I miss creating a character.
Uh-huh.
Because that's what you don't get to do in guiding. Although, uh-huh. You know, some people would say that, you know, when you're being a guide, you're being a version of yourself,
yeah,
kind of. So it is, you know, slightly a character. I was just thinking I might just shut the door because Andrew's just arrived, so there's some noise from downstairs, and then that's going to come out.
That's all right. You shut that door. And you mentioned him. You married
Sorry.
A comedian. I mean, what are the two of you like? Upstaging one another all the time, I should think, huh?
Wait, we do sometimes do a good double act.
Yeah, fantastic. And
yeah.
Andy guides a bit, doesn't he, as well?
He does,
yeah.
Yes. And he's, yeah, he would probably be doing a bit more guiding now, except that he's about to start doing a job that will be a decent length job, so... he's going to be busy with that for a while.
Right. So the gods were certainly smiling on us the day we got you, and you say that came about through that psychopath in 1888.
Yes. And also there was a connection that my mum knows Mary slightly.
Uh-huh.
So I think that was also... you know, I don't think I would have kind of written to you out of the blue going, hello, I see you do Jack the Ripper tours. So having that personal connection as well helped.
And how long have you been, how long have you guided with us?
I think it's about 21 years now.
21 years?
Because it was
That's
it was
impossible,
around about the millennium.
Fiona.
It's
you're only 26, for heaven's sakes.
Well, you know, as soon as I came back from the Middle East at the age of 5, I started doing Jack the Ripper walks.
Yeah. So let's talk about those courses then. So you did the city course, is that right?
Yes.
Is that the first one?
Yes.
And
so
you
that was about maybe not quite, somewhere between 10 and 15 years ago.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And then I had a couple of years kind of off, consolidating. And then I did the Westminster course.
Uh-huh.
And then I had another couple of years gap. And then I actually started teaching on the Westminster course.
Uh-huh.
And in that gap. And then I did the Blue Badge. So we finished the Blue Badge about 6 years ago, I think now.
Yeah.
And that's 2 years.
And every time you do one of these courses, you win the Guide of the Year award.
Well, each time you do a course, you've then got slightly more of a head start on,
I suppose
on
that's
other
true.
People. So, you know, going into the Blue Badge course, compared to a lot of... Some of my year had worked in tourism in various different roles, but not
uh-huh.
that many had done actual guiding before.
Yeah.
And by then I'd spent 10 years doing walking tours with London Walks. I'd also worked for Big Bus doing bus tours, which is also I started at the same time as doing walking tours, and I did that for a year or so. So I had this, and I had the City of London and City of Westminster courses under my belt. So I had a huge head start on everyone else.
Do you have any idea how demoralizing that must be for your fellow students? I mean, if I were teaching you and I had you demonstrate something, I'd say, right, that's it, I'm out of here, you take this class.
I think, I hope, that it was a useful, because, at least one of my fellow students has said that it was good to see, like, it was inspiring. So hopefully it was a useful example rather than anything depressing about it.
Yeah.
I think I should also say the Westminster course, I did get the top prize, but only by 0.5% across all the exams. I was 0.5% ahead of the person behind me. So
I'm going to embarrass you now, Fiona. I mean, you could so easily be a prima donna. And you're just anything but, you're so lovely and warm and friendly and modest and immensely likable. And, it's just the gods were smiling when your genes were combined, shall we say. So that's, yeah. Well, now, that's, how are you going to respond to that, young lady?
I'm gonna encourage my parents to listen to this.
Yeah, perfect.
Because they clearly did very well.
Yeah, perfect. And how many walking tours do you do now? How many are under your belt?
Oh, that's a good question. I've no idea. So before last year, I could count up the number that I was on the regular rota for. And it was probably about 8-ish. But then there's lots of others that I do as and, occasionally and things. So, I mean, when I used to keep notes in a shoebox on index cards, and I've got a shoebox full of walks.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But there's more that I've done since then. Yeah. So
I always, a new guide, if they've got cards, I say, I'll take them with you. You know, you can always sneak a peek at them when you're walking. And
yeah, and it's intriguing. There's a moment I always say when you, like, the first time that you almost forget to take them with you, and then you're there, and you think, oh, God, I haven't got my cards. So, also, because I think quite often people, I used to just read through them quickly while I was on the bus on the way or whatever, so it's just a sort of refresher. But you get to the point where you know the stuff, but you don't trust that you know it. The point where you suddenly think, oh, I didn't bring, no, I don't need them, I don't need them, it's fine.
It's is it your experience? It is certainly mine that the dangerous times are when you know a walk so well, you can sort of sometimes make the mistake of getting on automatic pilot with it. And then that awful moment, we must all, I'm sure even you, Miss Perfection, have had that moment when you're thinking, did I just say that?
What am I saying?
because you were thinking about, what was it Andrew told me I had to pick up at the shops before I got home?
But also, intriguingly, there's almost the... Yeah, no, yes, I have done that, absolutely. And particularly what's confusing is if you do the same walk twice, so sometimes we'll have a group who want to split in half, so you do half and then the other half, or, for whatever reason, you do the same walk in a day. And that's when it's really, the second time round, you're thinking, did I say this now, or did I say that earlier? And you sort of get confused. But intriguingly also, when I did the Blue Badge course, and I had about a year when I didn't do a Jack the Ripper walk at all, having done it quite regularly for quite a lot of years, when I came back to it, there were bits that I couldn't kind of remember. And then I would find that I was still talking and words were coming out of my mouth. And as I was saying them, I was thinking, oh yeah, this bit, I remember this. This is good.
Yeah.
And it just came out through pure muscle memory.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's the other side of the coin. I find, there goes the phone in the background, I find if it's a walk I only do once a year, I'm really, you know, alert and open and concentrating, and that's sort of slightly safer than, you know, my doing in the old days, the Along the Thames, every Friday night for, you know, 27 yes. years running.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, what's nice about doing a walk on a rote, with a rote or other people, is that you do it often enough that it stays embedded in your mind, but yeah. not so often that it becomes kind of routine.
Yeah.
But also, I mean, the lovely thing about London walks that you don't get with lots of other jobs is that you have the opportunity to polish something.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you do it a few times and then you kind of go, oh, actually that bit would work better here, and you mm-hmm. tweak it and you tweak it, and it becomes more and more kind of efficient in a way.
Yeah.
And that is such a privilege within guiding, to have the opportunity to repeat basically the same thing lots of times.
Yeah, I've said this a lot. I love it that, I mean, we're very much working in a so-called, it's almost ancient Greeks, it's an oral tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, a walking tour, when it's done the way we do it, it is really a living and growing and developing and changing thing. It's not set in stone. I mean, it's
yeah.
You know, the route will change sometimes, as well as the content.
But also it will be different every single time because you're with a different group of people.
Exactly.
And someone might say something that kind of, then you go off on a tangent, or, you know, so it's or something different happens, or the
yeah.
weather is different, so it's different, you know, so
yes.
it's never the same walk.
That, as Adam would call him, that rock star Tom Hooper, Elvis, the barrister, that little trick of his at the beginning of finding out where they're all from. And
mm-hmm.
then he's processing that, and
yeah.
he's going to tailor it, you know, in places, you know, because he's got a clutch
yeah.
of Germans, or he's got a couple of people from Montreal on the walk. I mean, that's so impressive.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
So,
and it's also, I mean, that's why, you know, there's some walks that you can do that more than others. The city is so lovely for guiding because it's so dense with stuff that you can alter where you go, and there's plenty to talk about, and you can kind of go, actually today I might go that way instead because I think this person wants to see something, you know, whereas some other walks you are a little bit more constrained because things are further apart, so
uh-huh.
it's harder to vary.
Yeah, and it depends on what you're reading at the moment as well, and sometimes even what you've heard in the news, and
yeah,
it's just all these wonderful variations. Fiona, what about the virtual tours? I mean, you've been a star in that respect as well. How many of those have you got?
These I have about. I think there's about four that I'm doing as public ones now, and I've got a couple of others that I have in mind that are sort of half done in a way. And then the ones that we've done for the tour series is, so there's another one, two, three,
they've worked a treat, haven't they, the ones that, I love that. It's such a joy.
And it's really nice at the moment, I think, particularly to be doing something that is collaborative.
Uh-huh.
You know, because we are obviously kind of so isolated. But it's also been really lovely as a guide to watch other people guiding, because that's the thing that we don't actually do very often. And it really makes you remember why people like to be guided in
exactly.
a way. So that's been lovely. But
yeah.
but to have a series that grows, and each story, like there's elements each week that get picked up on subsequent weeks, and that's been such a fabulous process to be part of.
It's been a reset in so many ways. I mean, for years, Mary and I have said, oh, we have to go on more walks, we have to go, and we never have had time.
Yeah.
Well, the virtual tours, we don't have to travel. Yeah, we can, and it's just, I've learned so much from you guys, and it's been a joy. The word's not an exaggeration at all.
But virtual tours as well, I think it's really interesting the way they have sort of developed during the year. And, you know, at the beginning, there was no rule about this is what it is as a genre, you know, because we were all discovering. And we have found the things that work for each of us, what works for each of us, I think. But it does, they do open up so many things that you can't do on a physical walking tour because just the stuff you want to cover is too far apart. So there's a whole host of themes that I think as guides we've all had in the back of our heads for years, and suddenly we're like, oh, I can do this now, and it works. So it's a really, you know, it what felt like a stopgap when we first started it now feels like a perfectly valid standalone thing.
Absolutely.
It's not the same thing by any means, but it's
absolutely,
it has its own pros and cons.
On my Kensington walk, I take them to the Cotswolds, I take them to Paris, and I take them to, wait for it, Detroit. And you're going to have to come on it, young lady.
And that's just the physical one that you do on the streets.
Yeah. So what's the most outlandish place you take them to on one of yours, Fiona, would you say?
Well, I've got a little bit of America. Coming into my statues. My statues ones, I've got a few statues from around the country here, and one from Scotland, and then a couple from America as well. So yeah, that's the furthest afield I've gone so far.
And we've just started back a week ago. Have you done one out on the streets yet, Fiona?
I haven't yet, no. I think the way the rotors have worked out, I'm towards the end.
So which one do you think you'll be starting with, probably? A walk in the city, will it be?
Yes, it'll be Old London, which is the 20-something
right
of April.
Did you and I, 15 years ago, did I take you over the ground for, what do we call it, something like the Forbidden City?
Yes.
Are you going to bring that? Can we bring that one back, do you think? What do you think?
Yeah,
I mean, you're a Westminster guide now.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. Well, we've been doing it in the repertory, so it has cropped up.
All right.
You know, once every 6 months or so, or whatever. I mean, that's intriguing because that's also one that I sort of thought, oh, yeah, I could do that as a virtual tour. But then the difficulty with virtual tours is sometimes in terms of sourcing images, and if some of the stuff that we want to use is copyrighted, then actually there's some walks you go, oh, I want to do this, this and this, and you look at the images you've got and go, oh, actually I can't use any of those.
Uh-huh.
Or those are, you know, so that's one that I would need to kind of go back and see if it's possible before I commit to doing it as
right
a virtual
on.
Tour, in a way, but it's one that would, because on the streets, so this is the old sort of the old Tudor palace of Whitehall is what we're talking about, isn't it?
Right.
And you know, when you're doing it on the streets, you're talking about stuff that's mostly not there anymore,
right?
So in you'd think that would be a perfect one to lend itself to being done online, because then you could show pictures of what
sure,
it used
sure.
to look like.
Sure.
But again, it depends whether those pictures are available or not.
Yeah. Yeah. Now let's, let's touch wood here. Maybe we're coming out of lockdown. Well, we know at least we're a little bit out of it. And let's say we get lucky and we get completely out of it. Where are you longing to get to? travel-wise.
Oh, travel-wise?
Yeah.
I'd like to go on a train.
I'd like to go on a train, yeah.
And I almost don't mind where, but a long, ideally an overnight train and a train with a buffet car. Even more than overnight, actually, what I want is a train with a, better than a buffet car, I want a restaurant. I want to eat a meal with a proper metal knife and fork on a train, because that's just one of the great joys of life. And I don't know why it's so satisfying. I mean, they're both nice things to do, be on a train and eat a meal, but you put the two together and it just feels, it's like going to the cinema in the afternoon. It's that sort of ridiculous indulgence
fantastic
thing that is a great joy.
And this could be a train, Orient Express, for example. I mean,
it could be, but it doesn't need to be.
Yeah.
It doesn't need to be a posh train. The furthest I've gone in one journey, and well, we came back from Berlin one time, but we also went to Lisbon a few years ago, and that was very lovely because if you go during the daytime, you know, you Eurostar in the morning, TGV through France during the day, and then you change trains on the Spanish border effectively.
Uh-huh.
And so you're going through the northern part of Spain through quite mountainous, fabulous scenery.
Uh-huh.
In the evening, sitting, and they had a sort of bar, you know, so you sit at a bar stool against a bar and the guy's making dinner for you and the sun is going down, and I mean, it's just beautiful. And then you go to bed and you wake up the next morning and you're nearly in Lisbon. And you have breakfast, the best meal of the day as well, also still on the train. It's delightful.
It just sounds like bliss.
Mm.
Just perfection.
Yeah.
Now, as you know, I suffer from an incurable case of bibliomania.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to know, one, what you're reading at the moment. And I want your favorite London books. So, yeah, what have you been reading during this past year?
I'm going to disappoint you very much in this last year. I've read one book during lockdown.
That's how busy you've been then.
Well, yes, I think, and also, but in the early days, I wasn't that busy, but reading was not the thing that I was able to do.
Uh-huh.
I've got the second book of Wolf Hall,
uh-huh,
whatever it is, Bring Up the Bodies. I had it on my Kindle, kind of, or tablet, anyway.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, this is the chance. This is my chance,
uh-huh,
to read it as a paper, on a proper book, because uh-huh, I won't have to be carrying it with me because I'm going to be at home anyway. So I bought it in, you know, solid form,
uh-huh,
specifically to read, and I haven't got anywhere near it.
Fiona, when you're on the tube or the bus, are you listening? Are you reading? Or are you looking at your fellow passengers?
Bit of both. I have started reading more. I don't particularly like reading books on electronic devices, but just the fact that you can have them with you on your phone. And we moved house about 2 years ago, so I have a slightly longer journey than I used to. So it's now worth reading, and I did find when we moved here I did start reading more.
Uh-huh.
And mostly kind of electronically. But it's a bit of watching other people as well.
Yeah.
Not so much listening. I don't like earphones and things, and so although I have been walking around in the last year, getting exercise, listening to podcasts and things, so I'm starting to listen to podcasts more.
All the time now, I'm out trying to learn French,
mm-hmm,
and I'm not having a lot of success. and then I think, I could be reading
yeah,
or listening to being read to, but.
But I'm thinking, I should be learning a language. You see, so you're doing what I'm thinking I should be doing.
Oh right.
So
yeah.
I did start a few years ago. I started learning Welsh, just through an app,
uh-huh,
and I'd already lapsed before lockdown, and I should have taken the opportunity to kind of pick it up again, and I didn't. But I did just hear the other day that my grandpa, in later life, regretted that he hadn't learned Welsh when he was young. So I thought, right, okay, I'm going to get onto this now.
Are you aware that the guide you shoveled our way, and I'm very glad you did, he's a tremendous addition to the team, talking about Steve, 10 languages, did you know that?
Steve.
Fannin?
I'm having a complete back. Oh, Steve, yes. I didn't realise quite that many.
Including, wait for it, Navajo.
Yeah.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
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 Well, there you go. Some people can pole vault. Some people are Usain, one person is Usain Bolt and can run, outrun a panther. And it's Some people can learn lots of languages easily. So
do you know, I think language learning, in this country, we do it at exactly the wrong time. I think if you get kids when they're really young, then, you know, it works. And, you know, there's kids who are bilingual because they've got bilingual parents or whatever. And that seems to work if you start young. Now, I appreciate the kind of logic of learning languages and I'm interested in them and it makes sense. And the concept of having a conversation with someone who I otherwise couldn't speak to is a good incentive. But when I was at secondary school, I just didn't get it. It didn't make sense. It was all about getting it right and grammatically correct. And it was just a frustrating process.
Yeah.
So I think school is wasted on secondary school kids.
I think that's true. Well, here's a thought that will both perplex you and awe you and make you wonder at the deep mysteries of being a human being. The next time you look at a two-year-old, Fiona, just entertain the thought that 2-year-old can learn 3 languages simultaneously, but he can't tie his own shoes. It's true.
That's true. And also, but kids who are bilingual, they also know which language to use to different people.
Yeah, extraordinary.
That's what I find astonishing.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. Well, let's end with books on London, both fiction and history. I mean, which ones have really impressed you? You know.
Well, okay, so starting with fiction, because that's an easier question to answer. The Rivers of London series I love, because it's a completely sort of parallel world that I entirely buy into.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know them?
No.
It's sort of
Ben Aaronovitch, is that his name?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a policeman in a very contemporary London, but also he in a world where magic exists and all of the rivers of London have gods and goddesses that personify them. And it's a really entirely plausible world, seems to me. But it's a nice mix of kind of genres almost.
Well, I'll certainly try that. Now, what about history? What about
Well,
have you read V.S. Pritchett's London Perceived? That's my favourite book on London. Do you know that?
Oh, no, don't know that. No, I'm just gazing at my bookcase as we are talking.
Yeah.
One I've came up the other day in conversation actually is by Leo Hollis called The Phoenix.
Oh yeah.
And that's all about rebuilding London after the Great Fire, and it focuses on a couple of individuals, and I think that's a really good book and has the most evocative description of the Great Fire that I've found in print in a way. And Lisa Pickard's books that,
sure.
I mean they've come up, we've mentioned them on the sort of on the tour series that we're doing, but so there's Elizabeth's London and Victorian London and they are fabulous because they've got so much detail about everyday life of kind of normal people. It's not just the royals or politicians or whatever. It's really practical information, like how paved were the streets and things like that, which is so important if you're trying to evoke a world.
Absolutely.
For other people.
Yeah.
That, you know, the sort of mundane things are the things that matter in a way.
Can I give you a little homework assignment then? Close this out.
Yes.
Cheeky of me. You know, John Julius Norwich, I think he died a couple of years ago, a historian, and he, for years, he would produce at Christmas time, I think it was just called Christmas Crackers, and it was a little commonplace book. You know, he would jot down, you know, quirky stuff in a little notebook, and it would end up being throughout the year. Then it would be published at this Christmas time. They were just delightful. And the other day, our colleague, Richard Walker, you know, and I'm in awe of his voice.
Mm-hmm.
He's just got the most wonderful voice. And he just mentioned to me, and he wasn't at all boasting, that's not Richard at all, but he said that he'd had a walker, young lady from Montana, and he thinks this is the high, and I think he's right, this is the highest compliment he's ever received. She said, "I want Richard Walker in my pocket narrating my life." And, you know, the light bulb went on. I thought, let's, as London Walks, as a team, let's create a commonplace book, an annual. There's 75 of us. If each one of us could come up with one thing like that, that would be fun. And then we can extend it. We can push it out. We can ask our walkers if they've got, you know, it just could be something kind of, you know, slightly off the wall, unusual, striking. And we as a team, as a community, counting our walkers, can create an annual London Walks Commonplace book. So
yes. would
you do that? Would you write down, just it just has to be one thing, but if you could do more than one, that, you know, we'll get something good going here. So
yeah, that sounds good.
That's your assignment.
I'm up for that.
And you've got 8 months.
Okay, that's fine.
And every day there will be at least one or two things that you... You know, we all kind of notice and take a fancy to, so, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm in.
Thank you very, very much. And we're going to be back here. We'll do this again, but this is great. So,
yeah.
Thanks so much.
Well, it's been a delightful interlude.
Okay. Well, I'm sure I'll be seeing you. If not before, on Sunday night. Is it you doing
It's not me. No, it's the Karen and Adam show this week.
Oh, the
week,
Karen
and
Adam, yeah.
Which right. I'm very much looking forward to.
What's your next letter, Fiona?
I'm the week after, so I'm just looking at P. P and R. And there's I found some fun stuff this morning for P.
Good. I can't wait. Okay. All right. Thanks a lot.
That's all. Thank you.
Yeah. Ciao.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.